Hey guys, just before we jump into the episode today, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast today. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. This episode is brought to you by the Psych Collaborative, our online psychology clinic bringing good quality, accessible therapy to you in the comfort of your own home. Hi everybody, welcome back to another episode. My name is Kat, I'm a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, a registered psychotherapist.
And together we are the Psychology Sisters, a podcast dedicated to normalizing the mental health conversation. Today we are chatting all things adult ADHD, an episode I'm so bloody excited to talk about. I feel like we have been requested this so many times, Ames.
We absolutely have. I think adult ADHD or ADHD in general is an extremely complex disorder and it's often really misunderstood as well.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But before we do get into the juicy part of the ep, Ames, how are you? How's life? How's lockdown? Give me all your info.
Well, probably much like a lot of people at the moment, I feel like I'm in Groundhog Day. It is the same old thing. I always feel a little bit, I guess, awkward when I'm chatting to people and catching up with people because I feel like I don't have anything new to share. And so I'm like, quick, okay, say something other than I've walked my dog 500 times or, you know, that I've read a book or I've been busy with work. But that's the truth. The truth is that nothing new or exciting has happened. And I guess that's, you know, part of that lockdown fatigue. And actually something that we didn't talk about last episode that I'm really feeling this week, more so than ever, is I'm just not wanting to talk to anyone. Oh, and that's really weird for me because I'm someone who, you know, really, I really love my friends and I put a lot of value and importance around the people in my life. And I have just found that this week, more so than any other week, I have just wanted to switch off, not talk to anyone and kind of conserve my energy because I've felt a little bit tired this week. But what about you? How have you been? How's your week been?
I literally feel exactly the same. I had this in my head, Ames. I was like, oh, I forgot to say this last time. I feel so similar to you. Like when people text me or like any communication, I look at it and I'm like, I just don't have the capacity. Like I just I know that I should, and I think that's where like so many shoulds come in. I should be connecting. I should be, you know, writing back and calling and Zooming all my friends. But I think it gets to it and I'm like, oh, man, like it takes me like five. I mean, I'm such a shit replier anyway, but now it's taken me like 5 to 7 business days to reply to people.
What's that meme? It's like adulting is just, I'm so sorry for the delay in my reply.
Yeah.
Constantly on repeat. Yeah.
Or it's like, sorry for not replying. I'm just low-key overwhelmed or something like that, which is so true. It's so true. I just feel like we're all in this. Like I feel like so many of my clients have said this as well. It's like, oh, I should be connecting. I should be talking to people. That's what everyone's telling me to do, but I just don't have the energy to. And it's this strange paradox at the moment, isn't it?
Of being isolated and disconnected, but not wanting to connect. Yeah,
exactly. And also I've found, I don't know if you feel the same, but I'm at this point where I just can't take in any information. Like I tried to do a PD the other day, or I tried to listen to a really, you know, I listened to quite a lot of like informative podcasts on my walks, and even just like learning dense and complex information, I can't, I just can't. My brain is just not having a bar of it. It is like, you know, read a trashy fantasy book, like read a story, read something that isn't information and dense. Don't read a textbook. Like I even podcasts,
I don't read a textbook.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I go back to my old school textbooks. But like I just I just can't take in any new information at the moment. I'm just obviously my executive functioning switching off. Like my brain's like, no, girl.
Absolutely. Yep. And I think, you know, that's why maybe ADHD has become a particularly hot topic for many people during COVID, because school, social work, other engagements that usually help structure our lives, obviously due to the pandemic, many of these normal and what we don't realize is quite, you know, routine activities have ceased. And for someone with adult ADHD or with someone without ADHD.
Are you diagnosing me at the moment?
No, not at all. But I think, and these are conversations that I've had as well, is that without, you know, the regular routine and without, you know, those other things that we really use to, I guess, fill up our cup and give us structure, we may bounce, you know, from task to task and not be able to concentrate, the brain fog, feeling overwhelmed, not knowing where to begin, and simply just mentally tapping out. Mm-hmm. Those are all, I guess, familiar feelings to ADHD. And it's funny, I remember speaking with one of my friends earlier on in lockdown about this. And I remember her saying to me, I feel like I have ADHD in lockdown. Mm. I feel like I'm baking 1 minute and I'm vacuuming the next. And then, you know, I can't concentrate and I switch from being kind of irritable and, you know, annoyed to kind of laughing and being happy. And, you know, it feels like I'm going a little bit nuts. And I guess when we look at it into context, that's probably a normal reaction.
Exactly. Yeah, it feels very strange. And also the crash, like the just exhaustion, the disorganization as well. Yeah, it certainly has some similarities. So yeah, I think this feeling is normal. Aims of just, if anyone's listening and feeling like this very like, ugh, like all of these strange things are happening, I think it's very normal. It's okay if you cannot consume anything complex or you can't write back to your friend at the moment. It's okay if you need to watch Friends or The Simpsons and just not fully engage at the moment.
Or just lay down, just have a rest. Yeah. If that's part of self-care.
Oh my God. I have so many clients reading self-help books at the moment and I'm like, it's great, but your brain is not there. Like we can't self-help at the moment. I think just put it away, read something fun, consume something that's easy, because I think we've been under this stress for so long.
Absolutely. And I think that plays into kind of wanting to distract from discomfort, right? It feels really uncomfortable having this kind of jittery, restless, maybe it's boredom, maybe it's that irritability. And we're, you know, wanting to drown that out or distract by listening to a podcast or listening to music or having TV on in the background or scrolling on our phones or picking up a book. But sometimes I guess the best way we can help self is just to practice being a little bit more present. And like I said, even if that is just going to lay down for 10 minutes and give yourself a rest rather than kind of constantly using stimuli to distract, which I guess inevitably ends up making us feel more burnt out and more frazzled. I guess that's how I felt this week. Really frazzled.
a bit scattered. I feel really scatterbrained.
Absolutely.
Week X, well, I don't even know what we're up to, week 11 of lockdown or something like that, week 12.
I think it's week 12. For me, I went into lockdown just before last school holidays because the school I was working at was in a high LGA area. And so it was like just the beginning of that week. And I think majority of New South Wales or majority of Sydney went into lockdown. I think it was the first week of school holidays. So I think it must be coming up to 11 or 12 weeks, which sounds so long.
It does. It's been so three months.
Oh my goodness.
It's been 84 years.
It's been 84 years.
It feels like that. But yeah.
Anyway, so is this introduction. Let's get into it.
Off mic, we were like, all right, short introduction, short and sharp. Ames, we never do anything short
and
sharp.
We can't do short and sharp, can we?
But long and
blunt. Apologies.
Alrighty, let's dive into ADHD. As we were talking about before, a highly, highly requested topic. I don't know if you felt the same, Ames, but ADHD has become quite under the spotlight lately. I feel like there is a few TikTok trends at the moment talking about ADHD, talking about people who have symptoms, and it seems to have created this curiosity or interest into ADHD. I wonder if you've heard the same from your clients or just hearing on social media, this interest in ADHD at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that may be an idea for another episode in the future, how I guess TikTok trends and viral videos can kind of play into maybe the unmasking of symptoms or I guess curiosity around mental health and self-diagnosis and all of that kind of thing. But absolutely, I would agree that curiosity around ADHD has definitely increased. I've noticed that I guess through clinical work and also personal, I have noticed that a lot of people around me have been using language like, oh, you know, that's my ADHD, or I'm just ADHD, or, you know, if they're having difficulty focusing, or, you know, they've learned about similar signs or symptoms that they might have. I think that's just my ADHD. I've definitely noticed that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost like a justification for lack of concentration, fidgeting, or all of those things. It's the, yeah, that's my ADHD. So what is ADHD? ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, and it is a pretty complex neurodevelopmental disorder, and it's usually diagnosed in children and adolescents. However, I think there's often quite a lot of misdiagnosis in childhood, or often it goes unnoticed or undiagnosed for quite a while. And I think that's why a lot of people as adults, after they receive a diagnosis, almost have a sense of validation or a bit of a sense of relief. So, you know, yes, it's mostly picked up in, it should be picked up in childhood, usually in school, in a school context, but certainly can go undiagnosed for many people. So what do you know, Ames? Talk to me about, you know, I guess there's quite a lot of stigma around ADHD, and I obviously you work in a school, and I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this, about the stigma around ADHD and I guess what stereotypes there are around ADHD.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the label in particular, ADHD as a deficit, doesn't help, because it's not a deficit issue at all. And I think that is part of the stigma. It's not a deficit of attention or a deficit in retaining information or regulating attention. It's more of, and when we say disorder, it's that our brain is disordered. There's, I guess, a disordered processing. So it might mean that it's not that you can't focus. It's that the brain finds it difficult to select something and pay attention to that thing. Unless it grabs your attention, then it's a hyperfocus. So it's like your brain switching between 30 different TV channels, and someone else has the remote, and then you get stuck on one channel and you can't move from it. So as Kat was saying, absolutely, often ADHD is misdiagnosed in schools. I definitely think there is more of a stigma around little boys because of behavioral components with ADHD. So oftentimes that can come out as disruptive behavior, as Kat was saying, fidgety or restless behavior. So for little boys, that can look like, you know, jumping off their chair or running out of the classroom. It can look like yelling out an answer when they haven't popped their hand up. And because generally teachers do come from, I guess, a behavioral educational lens, obviously they're educators, that lens does tend to, I guess, be a little bit more, maybe bias is the right term for noticing or observing those particular signs in little boys. It can also be misdiagnosed as anxiety, oppositional defiance disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and even for, I guess this is more common with adolescents and teenagers, even bipolar disorder, especially having that similarity in what's called pressured speech, which is just like, you know, talking. So sometimes I guess it is misdiagnosed, and there is a lot of misunderstanding around what ADHD actually is and how it can impact people, which definitely does have a really big impact, because often these children will then feel like they are just bad or naughty kids. For little girls, It might be that they just feel like there's something wrong with them, or that they're not smart, because people with ADHD often do struggle with the cluster of cognitive skills called executive functioning, which means it's not just one part of the brain, it's a whole system. So it includes planning, prioritizing, organizing, emotional regulation, decision making, completing tasks, and attention to details and all those things, which can be either picked up in a classroom as, you know, they're just not doing their work. If, again, coming, if an educator has more of that behavioral lens, or they're just, you know, they're being really, really naughty. They can't sit still. You know, they don't follow instructions. And that's what I do tend to notice in schools.
Absolutely. And I think there is this stigma around ADHD that it is maybe blamed on bad parenting, or that there's just something wrong with the child, right? And I think that that's not the case at all. You know, I think people with ADHD just have a different way of thinking and processing information. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. It's I think, a bit of an institutional failure in the way that mainstream school and study and work are not set up to help children with ADHD, and sorry, adults too, because I mean, a lot of the learning is rote learning.
It's goal-oriented learning, outcome-oriented learning. Yeah.
It's often not very, not really directed at children or adults who have ADHD, because I think, you know, it needs a lot of stimulation. You know, people with ADHD need a lot of interest focused stimulation, whereas a lot of mainstream schools and study and work doesn't seem, it's very goal oriented. And I think it's really not stimulating for someone with ADHD. And I think in turn that makes people feel like they're a failure, that they're not good enough, that they're not smart. In fact, people with ADHD are actually highly intelligent because they've had to adapt. You know, I think your brain works in one way and the world is telling you to make it work in a different way. So I think that that is such a sign of intelligence, right? Like that their brain has adapted so well to order, at least to even concentrate or to learn in a way that they're not supposed to. So I think anyone listening who may have ADHD, your brain, there is nothing wrong with your brain. Your brain just works differently. Imagine, like, you know, a normal brain, and I say this in quotation marks, no one has a normal brain, is like driving a car. You know, you drive a trusty car, you know when to stop, you know when to slow down, you know the road rules. Sometimes having ADHD is like driving an amazing red, I don't know why race cars seem to be red all the time, but an amazing race car. And sometimes you don't know when to press the brakes and you don't see the stop signs sometimes, but your brain is still just as powerful. It's a lot more powerful than the trusty old sedan. It's just knowing when to use it properly. I think that may be a good metaphor for ADHD, because there's this idea that there's something wrong or there's a flaw, but it's absolutely not that at all. It's just your brain works very differently. And when you harness it in the right way, or when you have the right strategies, even medication for some people, your brain can do amazing things. So I think it's really, you really want to destigmatize that there's nothing wrong at all with an ADHD brain. In fact, studies have shown that an ADHD brain is very high functioning. It's just knowing the right way to interpret information and use that energy is the key here, rather than there's something wrong with that person.
Yeah, absolutely. Love the old race car analogy. And I think that's a really good point too, where children are often either, you know, flying under the radar or misdiagnosed. When they do, they learn their own mental tasks to cope. And so often it's not until later in life where we see adults being diagnosed, because life gets more complex and unstructured. And, you know, we enter into adult relationships and full-time work, and symptoms may become more obvious then, or our, you know, mental tasks and strategies that we learnt in childhood become less effective.
Absolutely. What is the science behind ADHD, Ames? I know you spoke about executive functioning, and yeah, absolutely. I think brain studies or fMRI scans have shown that there's a lot of activity in your prefrontal cortex, which is where your executive functioning is. And I think people who suffer ADHD, and I shouldn't say suffer is such a bad word, isn't it? Because ADHD isn't a terrible thing. I think a lot of mental ill health isn't you know, suffering. I think people who have a diagnosis of ADHD do have trouble with the executive functioning side of things. It's the organization, it's the time management, it's the self-control, it's the self-motivation. All of those things are essentially what your prefrontal cortex, your executive functioning is helpful for, right? And also those with ADHD have been found to have low levels of the neurotransmitter and stress hormone norepinephrine. And norepinephrine is released into the blood as a stress hormone. And also the role of norepinephrine is increases alertness and arousal and also speeds reaction time. It also regulates someone's mood and ability to concentrate. So you can imagine if someone with ADHD has low levels of norepinephrine, that this will really interact and this will really impact on attention, on memory, on alertness and arousal, on reaction time. So I think it's really interesting to know that this is a really neurological concern here, is the neurotransmitters are not regulating. There's a lower level of dopamine as well. So I think when you really understand the science behind it, it's not that someone with ADHD is choosing to be fidgety or to have, you know, lack of concentration. I think it really comes back to this, you know, the dysregulation of the neurotransmitters in the brain.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think another kind of stigma is that ADHD is eating too much sugar or playing too many video games. And I think that is really important to understand that there are real things happening in the brain, you know, from that neuroscience perspective. And as you were saying, Kat, that dopamine or having, I guess, imbalances or difficulty with how dopamine is metabolized in the brain, dopamine fuels the control center and the reward system of our brain. So absolutely, the brain's braking system, as you're explaining, Kat, if we're looking at that race car metaphor that uses to plan, organize, and implement steps to achieve goals, which, you know, from a school learning educational framework or environment, that's generally what school means. It's all about outcome and achievement. So when we have, I guess, imbalances of dopamine happening, we tend to switch between different things constantly, and our overall self-regulation, well, we become dysregulated. So the control system is reversed, basically. So we're accelerated to chase short-term rewards. And absolutely, norepinephrine is the other key player in ADHD and also stress. We often talk about cortisol as the stress hormone, but norepinephrine works both as a hormone and a neurotransmitter. And as Kat was saying, the primary role of norepinephrine is arousal. So when we're stressed, absolutely, our prefrontal cortex, our thinking brain is switched off to make sure that we are doing the thing that we need to do to survive whatever is threatening us. So absolutely, when we're more aroused, when our feeling brain or our little, you know, as we've often said before, our smoke alarm or that amygdala, our stress response is activated, we literally cannot have executive functioning and responding to threat at the same time, activated at the same time. So what that can look like, I guess, in a classroom or at work or in a social situation is that we aren't able to attend to the things that someone sitting there who isn't stressed can attend to, because that part of our brain is switched off. So it may look like missing information. It may look like, you know, being a little bit confused or having that jittery, restless response, because we've got these neurotransmitters and these hormones pumping through our body responding to what is perceived as stress.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's such a complex interplay, isn't it, that really makes sense why symptoms emerge, you know, right? I think something as well with the fidgeting, right, for the hyperactivity, you know, criteria is something as small as fidgeting the hands. You know, I mean, I think that that's something that really people with ADHD can understand, is like, at school, they could never concentrate. You always had to be tapping their pen on the desk. You had to be fidgeting. You had to be kind of walking around. You might have been impulsive in calling out to the teacher, or, you know, often it's just getting up and leaving the classroom. And often in a work sense, it's quite similar in the way that you can't sit still. If you're doing a really boring, tedious task, it's so hard to concentrate, right? So something that research has found is that fidgeting, you know, in whatever way people fidget, actually increases the uptake or reuptake of neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine, in the way that, you know, ADHD medications do as a way to regulate, right? So it makes sense why you're, when you're trying to concentrate and you're trying to understand something in your environment, you're processing stimuli in a way that your brain isn't meant to process in the way that it's being delivered to you, such as in a classroom and a work situation. Your body's way of trying to increase the arousal, to increase your concentration and focus, is to fidget. It is, because fidgeting increases those neurotransmitters, which is trying to get you to concentrate. And so from the outside, what that looks like is naughty behavior, right? Like, stop tapping a pen on the desk, stop fidgeting, stop moving around.
Stop being distracting, stop being disruptive. Right?
What's wrong with you? Stop, just focus like everyone else. But someone who is going through ADHD, is that's their brain's very natural way of trying to concentrate. I mean, we all do that. We all kind of bite our nails, we all tap something, you know, even if we're not diagnosed with ADHD. And that is a very normal way to increase your concentration. It's just sometimes children or adults with ADHD will become so hyper aroused in the way of, they'll fidget so much they'll lose their concentration on something. Like, they'll, you know, get up and leave the classroom or leave the workstation because they just, it's too much. And that will then start to impede on your attention and productivity. But small things like fidgeting, like, I think that's why fidget toys exist in a way that, you know, it helps you to kind of, you can fidget something, you can kind of move around, but you can also stay concentrating on the task ahead. So I think fidgeting is such a natural way that research has found to actually, you know, increase the reuptake of these neurotransmitters, which is a way of regulating. So isn't that interesting that it has such a terrible stigma, and yet it's actually something that's trying to help children?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think when we go into some tips and treatment a little bit later, something that we'll probably talk about is rhythm. But when we think about things like fidgeting and tapping or rocking, rhythm is such a soothing, regulating response to things like anxiety, stress, distress, overwhelm. And when you think about it, we have rhythm as a regulator from the moment we are in utero. Yeah. When we're little babies inside our mum's tummy, we hear that heartbeat as a rhythmic, soothing regulator, co-regulator. And when we're babies, we're usually rocked or tapped or, you know, bopped to soothe when we might be feeling distressed or, you know, hyper aroused if things are happening that are scary. And so it's normal and natural, you know, to kind of tap on the desk or, you know, to rock in your chair automatically as a way of soothing nervous energy or anxiety when we might be in a bit of a stressful environment. And absolutely, when we're a child and we're getting punished and yelled at for doing that, it then kind of exacerbates, as Kat was saying too, that narrative around, or there's something wrong with me, or I can't do things that I should be able to do, you know, I can't manage things well. And then, you know, that we can talk about that a little bit later too, that tends to lead to all sorts of things as adults. But absolutely, fidget toys are part of regulating, or fidgeting in general is part of our natural instinctive rhythmic regulation.
Absolutely. So let's go into symptoms. Let's go into what does ADHD look like? What is the clinical diagnoses for ADHD? And there is three categories of ADHD. One is inattention and one is hyperactivity impulsivity. So essentially you can have both. So there's inattention ADHD and hyperactivity impulsivity, or you can just have one or the other, right? There's three different diagnoses there. So talk to me about inattention, Ames. What are some symptoms of inattention ADHD?
Yes. So inattention can look like often failing to have close attention or attention to detail. So that might look like sometimes making seemingly careless mistakes in either schoolwork or at work or other activities, you know, social events. It might be forgetting to plan things or forgetting to book things, even bills, forgetting to pay bills as adults. It might be trouble holding attention on certain tasks that don't interest us or playing activities. It might look like you're not listening, or often there is trouble being spoken to directly. Often, you know, not able to follow instructions and fail to finish duties. So say in the workplace, losing focus and getting sidetracked. So things are left unfinished, trouble organizing tasks and activities, avoiding things that we don't like or tasks that require a lot of mental effort or tasks that require a long period of time, losing things necessary for tasks like USBs, I've done that a lot. Wallets, keys, glasses, I've also done that a lot. Even things like mobile phones. So often easily distracted, often forgetful in daily activities. And I think what's really important to note too, that with ADHD, a person diagnosed with ADHD must have several symptoms, so usually six, and several symptoms must have started before the age of 12, and difficulties must be present in two or more settings, so such as work or with friends or relatives in other activities, and there must be clear evidence of symptoms that interfere or reduce the quality of functioning or development that aren't due to any other mental disorder. So I think that's really important. And two, I guess ADHD is also on a spectrum. So we can have, you know, mild, moderate, severe based on symptom severity as well. So just because you have, a little bit of difficulty concentrating doesn't mean that you have ADHD. However, you also don't have to have all of these symptoms in, you know, major severity to have ADHD as well. So mm-hmm. I think that's important to keep in mind. But Kat, would you like to take us through what the hyperactivity and impulsivity symptoms look like?
Yes, absolutely. I think as well is that over 17 years old, you just need to have five of the symptoms. So if you're an adult, it can just be five of those rather than the six. It's very cookie cutter diagnosing, you know, so it doesn't mean that if you only meet four that you, yeah, as Ames said, it might be more of on the mild spectrum. So hyperactivity and impulsivity. So what you would look for, or what symptoms you might look for this category, is the fidgeting, it's the tapping, it's the squirmy. It's in a school setting, you would leave your seat in a situation where you're supposed to be sitting down, or even in a work setting or in the middle of a meeting, if you just can't sit still. You know, you might be running as a child, running or climbing when it's not appropriate, for example, you know, in the classroom or in a work setting, I don't know how people climb in a work setting, but you never know. Unable to take part in leisure activities quietly. It's almost as if you feel like you're driven by a motor, like you just got an engine and just go, go, go. You're that red race car who just isn't able to stop where appropriate at the stop signs. It may look like talking excessively. It may look like blurting out an answer before a question has been completed. It may be difficulty waiting your turn or becoming quite impatient. It may also look like interrupting or intruding others' conversations. So yeah, I think, you know, as Ames was saying, with the inattention, six or more symptoms under 16 years old, or five or more over 17 years old, will meet the criteria for ADHD. Mm-hmm. So yeah, as we were saying, you can have a combined presentation, and if you can meet both of those, you can also have predominantly inattentive, which is just the inattentive category, or you can have predominantly hyperactivity impulsive as a presentation. So yeah, and also symptoms can change over time, the presentation can change over time. You can become diagnosed maybe as a child with predominantly hyperactivity impulsive, that can actually change to predominantly inattentive, or vice versa. So certainly the presentation can change from childhood to adulthood.
Mm, absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's also a myth that we grow out of ADHD. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we hear a lot, like, oh, you know, as children, you'll just grow out of it. But I agree. I think it's more that symptoms can change, or that, as we discussed earlier, we adapt and we learn new strategies and skills to cope better, or to function, quote unquote, normally in the world. I think as an adult too, you know, we're reading out the criteria, or we're listing the criteria. As an adult, what that might look like is a lot of stress around not being able to get things done and being forgetful. Like I said, like paying bills, calls or missing appointments. It might be feelings of inadequacy and imposter syndrome in professional roles due to perceived lack of discipline, which is that inattentive sign and symptoms coming out. So it does look like a lot of difficulty with work, and it's not uncommon for adults with ADHD to change jobs frequently because and they don't often feel fulfilled or satisfied by their work as well. So that can also look like difficulty entering and staying in meaningful relationships, difficulty sitting through a movie or reading a book. Oh, self-esteem is definitely something that's impacted through, you know, frustration of failures or feeling again like something's wrong with me, I can't do things as well as other people, not being able to finish anything, you know, definitely has a compiling impact when it comes to frustration around failure and having multiple things on the go, so never really getting that sense of achievement, drifting off or daydreaming, losing things again, forgetfulness. Adults with ADHD are often diagnosed and struggle with depression and anxiety, which makes sense, especially if they're, you know, felt like they haven't belonged in peer groups during childhood, or, you know, again, there's always that narrative of something wrong with me, being told as a kid that you don't learn well, or that you're not learning right, or that you don't fit in, you can't do things properly. It can look like a lot of impulsivity, like overspending, trouble, you know, maintaining or having a budget, you know, shopping trips make you feel better temporarily, again, that dopamine, but then feeling quite regretful later. Or another part of that impulsivity might be risky behavior, like drug taking, sexualized behavior, alcoholism. That feeling of being on edge all the time means that we can have, I guess, a correlation to addictive coping mechanisms to manage as well. It's interesting that we use a speeding car analogy because a lot of, and again, this is a generalization, but adults with ADHD do tend to get a lot of speeding tickets. And then again, that indecision. So what that can look like in adulthood is spending 4 or 5 hours at the grocery store because it just feels overwhelming trying to make decisions. And, you know, we're confronted with all of the stimuli of the colored shelves and things like that. So little things can push you over the top, and we can become dysregulated in that sense too.
Yeah. And going back to drug use as well, I mean, think about it. A lot of recreational drugs will have a temporary increase in dopamine, yeah. Right? Yeah. So of course, I mean, there's such a high prevalence of drug use and ADHD because drugs do the very thing your brain's lacking. So it really, really makes sense. Also, you talked about overload, and I think that's really something important to touch on is people who have ADHD may suffer from cognitive overload. So people with ADHD have heightened awareness of a lot of the incoming stimuli, as Ames is talking about. As people who don't have ADHD, we enter a supermarket, we can drown out the noise, we can drown out the colors, we can drown out, you know, those chocolates that are $2 in front of us. Well, depends on the time of the month, but mostly we can focus on what we need to do, right? People with ADHD will walk into a supermarket and be really overwhelmed by the stimuli, and that might be all the colors, it's the sounds, it's the music, it's the touch, it's everything that's going on inside a supermarket. They are so bombarded by the normal stimuli in their environment that they cannot filter out background noise. And that really, really causes issues in focusing and concentrating on the task at hand of getting in, getting bread, getting eggs and walking out, right? Because of this inability to focus, those with ADHD have real trouble completing a task because it can become really cognitively overwhelming. And I think as well, something interesting to note is those with ADHD often will have a comorbidity with autism spectrum disorder, which is that difficulty with processing sensory stimuli. So I think in order, you know, treating ADHD, a really important part is understanding sensory sensitivities. If music is something that is overwhelming, how can we implement, you know, or remove that from studying or doing your job? Or if you enjoy moving, if moving is helpful for you or not helpful. So I think it's really part of the treatment of ADHD is understanding the sensory sensitivities because it is really overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit more about the cause of ADHD. Kat, what do we know about where ADHD comes from. How do we get ADHD?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of studies have come to the conclusion that ADHD is certainly genetic, although it's not as strongly researched, or it's not, there's not as strong or robust conclusions to suggest that it's purely genetic. Often, yeah, it certainly can be. If you do have someone in your family with ADHD, that may be an indicator that you're more vulnerable to developing ADHD. But interestingly, studies have found that exposure to toxins such as lead, found mainly in paint or in pipes, especially during, if your family or your mother had, was exposed to toxins, can certainly increase the risk of developing ADHD for the child. Also, maternal drug use, alcohol use, or smoking during pregnancy has been found to increase the risk of developing ADHD for the newborn. So yeah, certainly genetic, and there are some environmental impacts here. But it's interesting. It's not kind of, you know, how something like anxiety or depression, there's a pretty clear correlation of, you know, this is genetically predisposed. Something with ADHD, it, there has been found to be links, but it isn't as strong as what other disorders will come up with.
Absolutely. And I guess just on that, I guess coming from a trauma lens and maybe a little bit contrary to the common medical model framework, but I really see ADHD's origins in early childhood stresses. So during the first, I guess, few years of crucial brain and personality development, you know, having, I guess, multi-generational family stress and trauma, there's a significant overlap with trauma and ADHD signs and symptoms too, which I think is really important to understand, especially as ADHD is a very complicated disorder. And what I observe in people with ADHD, adults and children, is similar to what we would observe with trauma or PTSD, that hyperarousal and hypervigilance, not being able to attend to the here and now, and trouble focusing on key, I guess, things in front of us, are all markers of trauma and a dysregulated nervous system. And as we said, the neurotransmitters, I guess, that work with our stress response are activated with people that have ADHD. So if you have a developmental experience that dysregulates your nervous system, your dysregulation impacts systems in the brain, like executive functioning. So hypervigilance and dissociation, for example, could be mistaken for inattention. Impulsivity might be brought on by a stress response in overdrive. So traumatized children will often find it difficult to control their behavior and will shift, you know, from one mood to another. They might drift into a dissociative state while reliving a distressing memory, or lose focus while anticipating, you know, something bad happening or the next violation of their safety. So the part of the brain that controls impulses, for example, shuts off that survival instinct. So that survival instinct can respond, like we were talking about before with the norepinephrine. So yeah, I guess I really like to discuss that with parents that suspect that their child might have ADHD, or adults that suspect they have ADHD. I think really understanding that a dysregulated stress system can get in the way of development. It rewires our brain and often looks like quote unquote bad behavior. So meltdowns, attention problems, lack of concentration, irritability, trouble making friends, poor impulse control. And often we pathologize those symptoms, and more parents are stressed too. So that means a more stressful environment for the developing child. And I think in Western society and culture, we usually do have a behavioral approach as well, which means we don't address the cause. We just punish the bad behavior. Mm. So people then tend to be more stressed and more stressed than we're consciously aware of, because that's what's familiar in our environment. It's all we know and it seems normal. So those ADHD traits like tuning out, distractibility, first develop as an emotional defense mechanism against all kinds of distress and, you know, adverse childhood experiences. And a child can grow up thinking, again, that they're stupid or there's something wrong with them, when really they're responding in a way that has served them to keep them safe in a stressful environment. As adults, you know, they can grow up being you know, quote, for lack of a better word, workaholics or perfectionists as an adaptive coping strategy. I think when we're looking at genes, for the most part, genes don't make anything happen. They're a set of potentials, and given an environmental input, we can have, I guess, a higher percentage or a high statistical percentage that something will happen with those set of potentials matched with an environmental input. Especially in early childhood, our brains are very much affected by our primary caregiver's relationship, and the brain is in constant interaction with the environment. So something can absolutely be biological without necessarily being genetic. And I think too, looking at ADHD children with their, you know, temperament are generally highly sensitive, and that is in fact predisposed and does contribute to developing ADHD. When something's either even, you know, the slightest little bit off in the surrounding environment, stresses, you know, in the parent relationship, for example, will trip those little stress alarms much more readily than other children. And again, that might look like bad behavior. And so then parents tend to punish the bad behavior, feeding into that cycle. So I think that's really important to understand too when talking about causes and presentations.
Yeah, I love that. I think, yeah, you're right. With any genetic predisposition, there is a vulnerability there, but not a certainty, right? But it's often the environmental situations or a stressful environmental situation can trigger the onset of ADHD, which is really important to make note of. Something that also people with ADHD may suffer that I found when doing my research, which is interestingly not in the DSM at the moment, is something called rejection sensitive dysphoria. And this is really interesting. I've read in some studies that 99% of ADHD people who do suffer from ADHD will experience rejection sensitive dysphoria. Have you heard of this before? I had not heard of this before I'd done my study.
I actually haven't heard of this before, but I think everyone is pretty sensitive to rejection, right? I think it's our natural human innate need to be in relationship and to connect with others as relational human beings. So I can imagine we're all pretty highly sensitive to rejection and would be pretty depressed if we weren't getting it. But
exactly,
it's interesting that it has a name.
Exactly. And I think this is certainly an adaptive response to feeling as though you've failed or feeling as though you don't fit in, right?
Of course.
It's essentially an intense vulnerability to the perception, not the actual reality of being rejected, teased, or criticized by important people in your life. So rejection sensitive dysphoria causes extreme emotional pain that you may have also triggered by a sense of failure or feeling as though you've fallen short or failing to meet someone's expectations. I mean, given that a lot of children go through mainstream school, I think this idea that you failed mainstream school, but I think looking at it like mainstream school has failed you, right? You cannot learn the same way as other people. But I think if you're continually told that you failed or you're not good enough or you're different, as you're saying before, Ames, of course you're going to feel this heightened sense of rejection sensitivity. I think people who do have ADHD describe it as, you know, they can't even find the words to feel the pain that they feel when they are rejected, or they feel like they've been stabbed in the heart when they get, you know, when they have a feeling of rejection.
Or procrastination. So they just don't try. They just won't do it because they're so scared of criticism or rejection. And that's a pretty normal response.
Exactly. And I think when someone internalizes the emotional response, because it does, you end up internalizing, right? It can look like a sudden development of a mood disorder, which is where the comorbidity with depression may come in. You may feel as though you're more sensitive than other people. You may feel as though that any rejection or criticism or teasing really strengthens or reaffirms this idea that you're a failure. So certainly you can understand going through life where being told that you're different or a failure or you've failed something, it will increase your sensitivity to that in the future, right? Like that's a very common adaptive and defense mechanism, you know, to stop yourself from getting hurt, as you said, Ames. You almost stop trying. You maybe have a sense of learned helplessness with work, study, relationships, right? So, something that I found was really interesting that isn't in the symptoms, but this rejection sensitive dysphoria, where you feel rejection so strongly, is really common amongst ADHD sufferers. Ames, talk to me. We want to learn the difference between the presentations of ADHD in males versus females. So rock and roll. Talk to me about that.
All righty. Rock and roll indeed. So I think this is another so stigma. I know. Rocking out to ADHD. No, so there's no gender difference. Again, I think this is a stigma and an outdated stereotype. ADHD impacts both genders equally. And I think part of the stereotype that makes us think otherwise is that there can be different presentations. So generally, again, I'm using that term generally, because this is not true for everyone, but boys generally tend to be labeled with the more hyperactive, impulsive kind, which can look like the disruption, fidgety, restless, impulsive outbursts kind of behavior, which is, again, noticed more in a school environment. And I guess educators tend to be more aware of this behavior in boys. And for little girls, again, generally, what happens is we tend to explain these signs as character traits rather than understanding them as, I guess, difficulty with executive functioning. So a little girl might be thought of as just chatty, or she daydreams a lot. And later in life, or, you know, maybe even at the time, she might be diagnosed with anxiety or depression rather than ADHD, because it's less visible and I guess less noticeable in terms of behavior. So women with ADHD face the same feelings as men do. However, it may or can tend to generally present in different ways. So boys with ADHD, it's often more externalized, and with little girls, we tend to, I guess, kind of label their personality rather than, I guess, understanding that there may be an underlying reason for why they might find it hard to concentrate, or why they might be more chatty or a bit more forgetful. Yeah, and I think all of these things too play into, for both genders, that feeling of inadequacy, trouble with stress, emotional regulation, and having really low self-esteem and self-worth. Because again, little boys will get labeled as naughty or bad, and little girls, you know, they might be labeled as ditzy or spacey. And as Kat was saying, it is not a reflection on intelligence at all. It is just that our brain is processing things differently.
Absolutely. Interestingly, a study in 2014 found, and I'm sure there's a more recent one, but 2014 found that teachers will refer boys over girls, even when showing this exactly the same symptoms, to a medical professional for ADHD for treatment, right? So teachers in this study, even though exactly the same symptoms were being expressed by both boys and girls, teachers were more likely to refer the boys for medical treatment over the girls. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And I so agree with that, because I do think, like I said, generally, like, but little girls and boys can have the exact same presentation. But I think ADHD, again, and I'm going to say stereotypically, especially from that, you know, school environment lens, is almost viewed as like a male disorder. Like, I think very rarely we have the association of ADHD with little girls. So it's only recently, now that, you know, there is so much more, I guess, information and education available in a school system, and understanding that it doesn't choose which gender it prefers. But yeah, I definitely see that study playing out, that teachers are much more likely to label little boys than they are little girls.
Yeah, and I wonder where this often, I remember working in school, that girls who were quite impulsive or displayed that hyperactivity, impulsivity side of ADHD were attention seeking. There must be something going on at home in order for them to be seeking this attention. Which so didn't,
it goes back to character traits,
right?
Isn't that funny? Yeah.
Which didn't seem to have the same narrative around boys.
Or same validation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the same validation. Always, they're just attention seeking, or they're just daydreaming. They're just spacey. It's very dismissive, isn't it?
Yeah. ADHD does not discriminate, but I think it often will, the misdiagnosis will discriminate. I think certainly there tends to be a bit of bias when diagnosing or even picking up ADHD symptoms among both males and females.
Absolutely. And I feel like as adults, where there can be challenges here is that if we look at, again, I guess, societal pressures for, I guess, those should expectations, again, for women, it is that women are you know, societal expectations, again, can't reiterate that enough, are meant to be organized and self-controlled and good planners, and I guess keep a house running well, you know, not to be messy, to be polite, to be quiet, good girls. You know, those are messages that women are fed constantly. And so I think that feeling of inadequacy and failure and embarrassment, like there's something wrong with me, really speaks to women who tend to seek treatment for ADHD, because they feel like their lives are so out of control. You know, like I said before, if it's finances might be in chaos, or they feel like they can't manage their time, or, you know, they can't successfully, and successfully in quotation marks, keep up with the demands of their job, or they feel, you know, even just simple daily tasks like laundry and cooking and that type of things feel really overwhelming and exhausting, can often bring women, again, with a little bit of information, to be curious around ADHD, because it does explain why all of those things feel really, really hard.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, delving into relationships, like the challenges someone living with ADHD might have in relationships is forgetting or drifting away or not being really present in a conversation. I think, Ames, you mentioned the brain fog, and I think certainly in these conversations that aren't interesting or stimulating, someone with ADHD might find themselves not listening, you know, when their partner or their friends are talking. They really have trouble engaging and connecting in that way, and that can feel so isolating, right?
Absolutely.
And I think, yeah, it certainly, you may notice that if you're someone who struggles with staying attentive during a conversation, that your mind wanders, and then you feel really guilty. You feel like, yeah, you aren't being a good partner or friend or daughter or whatever. And often
Absolutely.
People with ADHD will overcompensate, and they'll feel really guilty. So maybe they'll make up for it and be really generous with their money, or their, you know, they might buy their friend something or their partner something, because they feel this kind of guilt, right? And it can be this really, this cycle. It really does also play into this low self-esteem and low confidence and low guilt. I feel like there's such a self-punishment aspect of ADHD. Like, why can't I do this? Like, why can't I listen to my partner? Why can't I remember Absolutely. Their birthday? What's wrong with me, right? And I think there's nothing wrong with you. Your brain is just working very differently and prioritizing stimuli differently to what other brains may do.
Absolutely. And I think too, because a lot of the time we're spending so much of their energy and their focus trying to cope with work and organizing life and meeting, you know, physical demands, that relationship demands can sometimes just be that one extra thing that can compile and be really overwhelming for someone with ADHD.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that work sense as well, like you may find at work, you really struggle to concentrate when everyone's around. If you're in an open plan office, which seems to be quite common, you may find you really struggle to concentrate with all the stimuli around you, the noises, the people going back and forth, or if you're in a work environment where it's really overstimulating, where there's a lot going on, you may notice that you work better early in the morning before anyone's there or late at night. You may find that you're not productive when given your work environment, or if your environment's messy or unorganized, you may find that you really struggle with the work side of things, or if you don't have a routine. If you're working from home at the moment, likely if you do have ADHD, you may be really suffering without having a specific routine to follow at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's where sometimes perfectionism can develop as a coping strategy, you know, typically following that frustration of not being able to get things done to the standard that is expected. You know, often that will look like having extremely high, rigid standards for quality or details and performance, which explains some of the difficulties in completing tasks in a work setting or in relationship even, because it's that thinking of I can't finish because it's not perfect yet, you know, just a little bit more time. And often this leads to missing deadlines, from problems of you know, letting go of, you know, or you know, other things end up monopolizing the time, effort, and energy. And then there's also that, I guess, circumstantial perfectionism of I'm too tired right now, or you know, now's not the right time. And this may be true as adults with ADHD, you know, who are more prone to distractions. However, you know, this runs the risk of including or heightening avoidance, which turns into a belief of, oh, I can't trust myself to do things, or I can't rely on myself to do things, which typically results in that procrastination. So then it's like this perfectionist procrastination cycle that creates many, many pain points in the lives of those with ADHD. And often describe the experience of setting out a reasonable plan for the day or for the hour, not getting it done, and then beating themselves up for lost opportunities, you know, and that can be really, really uncomfortable and cause, as you were saying, Kat, a lot of guilt and distress. And I think too, that can play out in friendships as well, you know, navigating social rules, you know, like you were saying, when our mind drifts during conversations and then feeling guilty and ashamed, you know, for not being able to be present with friends. And then we can, exactly right, be like, okay, well, I just need to be the perfect friend. Mm-hmm. I just need to, you know, make sure I'm pleasing that person as best as I possibly can. And then they won't think that there's something wrong with me.
Mm, absolutely. It's interesting. It creates a paradox going back to the avoidance perfectionism cycle, right? Because I mean, people with ADHD are interest-based driven, right? Like they will fixate on something that they love. Often they can be quite creative in that sense and become quite fixated on something, right? And it would create a paradox because you'd want it to be perfect because you failed so much in your life, right? So you fixate on something, you get really excited about something. You might be, a really great painter and you know, you just lose yourself in it, right? But then you have this experience of, oh, but I fail or I'm not good enough. So is this going to be good enough, right? So it would create a paradox, this perfectionism and also this rejection, the rejection dysphoria, right? Like I love this and I'm really good at it. I'm really interested in it. But I've also had experiences where I've been rejected or criticized before. So it's not good enough, right? Maybe I shouldn't do this thing that I really love to do. And I find that so common. People who suffer ADHD is, I love this and I'm so interested and passionate about this, but I just can't finish it. I just can't get to it, you know, maybe out of judgment or, you know, or fear of rejection.
Absolutely. So we've got a couple of questions, which we are so grateful for those of you that write to us with your questions. We love hearing from you, and we love being able to make sure that we have content in our podcast that is really helpful and interesting for those that are listening. So I have tried to incorporate questions and we've popped, you know, information throughout the podcast that people, I guess, were more interested in, but we have a few questions around treatment and how to manage ADHD. So Kat, what does it look like? How does someone approach speaking with a therapist or a doctor or, you know, a mental health clinician around, you know, if they feel like they might have some of the signs and symptoms of ADHD? How do you approach that?
Really good question. I think firstly, you know, acknowledging that, you know, it's great that you're showing curiosity into your symptoms and it's great that you have some awareness. I think that that's so wonderful. I think ADHD is so often misdiagnosed. So I think, you know, always showing interest and curiosity into you and your symptoms is wonderful and your way of thinking is awesome. I think when you are approaching with a therapist or doctor, it is as simple as, hey, I've noticed X, Y, and Z. You know, I've noticed that I'm really fidgety, or I really have trouble concentrating. I've noticed that it's impacting on my social life or my relationships, and I'm just wondering if we can explore this a little further. You know, I think that there may be something here, but I kind of want to explore this with you. You know, as simple as that. I've had so many clients come to me with really similar questions, like, hey, I saw on TikTok, or I just feel like there's something else there. Can we explore this? And you may not even know what it is. I think it's just outlining some symptoms, like, oh, I really struggle with getting motivated, or I really, really struggle with finishing tasks, or I really struggle with this. Is this something we can explore together? I think you don't have to know the answer. You don't have to have a diagnosis. And this goes for any, you know, any kind of disorder. It's just, these are my symptoms, and I'm just wondering if we can explore this. This could be it, but I want to get, you know, your opinion. And I think self-diagnosis is, in a way, it's good to be curious, but I think it's also good to have the support from a therapist or a doctor. And I think also as well, a psychiatrist is going to be a really good key player in your diagnosis of ADHD. Doctor and psychologist or a therapist can certainly screen and can certainly look at your symptoms. The best practice for diagnosing ADHD is through a psychiatrist who will be able to make that call. Although so many psychiatrists are fully booked at the moment, it's actually really hard if you're in Australia right now to get in to see a psychiatrist. So you can certainly keep exploring this with your therapist. Even if you are, you know, you do have symptoms, what you can do is work on those symptoms, right? Regardless of a diagnosis or not, work on those symptoms with your doctor or your psychologist or your therapist. And we can work through that without having a diagnosis if you find that that process is hard to get into the psychiatrist. So yeah, that's kind of how I would approach it.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. The only other thing I would add is it can be really daunting if you start to, I guess, really resonate with some of the signs and symptoms of ADHD, and that whole process can feel really, really daunting. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to acknowledge too. And I guess one helpful reminder might be that you are the expert on you. So if you feel, hey, like this really feels like it fits my experience, and you go to see a doctor or anyone else, and they tell you that it's something else, or they give you advice or recommendation that doesn't fit right for you, go somewhere else. Yeah, go and get a second, third, fourth, fifth opinion, because ADHD is very complex and it is often misdiagnosed, and there are so many stigmas around ADHD. Knowing that you are the expert on you, I think, can be really helpful to kind of alleviate some of that daunting, nervy process that it is. Yeah. So if you feel that, hey, actually, this really fits for me, this really resonates for me, then no one is more expert on you than you are. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important to remember too.
Yeah, I love that. And a diagnosis can be really validating, but also really scary. So I think. You know, sitting with all of these feelings, it can be overwhelming, or it can be validating, or it can be both. So just, it's okay if you do receive a diagnosis or you don't, you know, it can be really difficult, or maybe not.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think too, yeah, absolutely. A diagnosis is just a symptoms checklist. Yeah. Just a symptoms checklist. It's not your identity. It's not saying that something's wrong with you. It doesn't label your whole existence. It's just saying, hey, you meet the criteria for this, and here's a treatment guidance plan. Here's some, you know, research to indicate what might be helpful. That's really, really in a nutshell all that it is.
Yeah. It's like saying your brain's a red race car and you're not a sedan anymore.
Well, you've always been a race car.
Yeah. It's your driver's instruction manual.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So next question that came through a lot is how to support a family member or a partner with ADHD.
Great question. I think if you're supporting someone with ADHD, especially how it shows up in relationships like we spoke about, you may feel ignored. You may feel unappreciated. You may feel as though, you know, the person with ADHD that you're with doesn't listen to you or forgets details. And I think you can maybe feel like you're really taking care of this person. Like you have to remind them, you have to, you know, tell them, you know, repeat what you've said to them because they may be zoning out or they may be fidgeting. You may feel as though you can't rely on your partner. You feel like they don't follow through with their promises. And that can be so difficult to sit with. I think it can be such a perception of, well, does this mean that they don't love me? Or I feel like I'm doing all this work and I'm not getting appreciated. So it's so difficult to be the partner of someone with ADHD, just as difficult as it is to be the person with ADHD, because no doubt they know how you're feeling, they know what they're doing, and it's really hard for them to stop. I think it's acknowledging that it's definitely not intentional. It's just the neurological processes in their brain, right? So I think the best thing you can do is learn about ADHD, learn about what's happening in their brain, learn that it's not malicious intent, it's not on purpose, it's just a neurological response to their external stimuli that this person is trying to process, right? You know, so understanding how ADHD works, understanding your partner's, you know, perception of ADHD, how their red race car's working, I think as well, try not to parent. Often with ADHD, you may feel as though you're parenting your partner and telling them and having to look after them. But I think shying away from that rather than just remembering that you're their partner, you're not their parent, having those clear boundaries, emphasizing their strengths. You know, people with ADHD have incredible strengths, right? They are, you know, they know so much, their brain works so differently. So emphasizing those strengths, emphasizing their creativity, emphasizing their sensitivity, you know, whatever it might be for that person. Separate your partner from their ADHD. Their ADHD is just one part of them. It's not all of them. It can be helpful. Being patient, you know, communicating in more ways than one. So communicating verbally, also writing things down if you think that they may not remember something. From a very pragmatic point of view with household chores, I think this seems to be a bit of a soft spot for people, for couples in relationships who do have one or two with ADHD. It's breaking down the household tasks, writing it down, having a schedule, having a routine, having it, you know, expressed on the fridge, as well as reminding someone verbally, having alarms on your phone. Like, those things can be really helpful from a very practical sense. Listen to how they're feeling, and also reducing clutter and having a more organized environment can be really helpful. What do you think, Ames? Anything to add on to that?
I think you pretty much covered it all. I would agree. The only other thing I would recommend is maybe if you are in a relationship with someone that has ADHD and you don't have ADHD, accessing your own support would be really, really important, whether that be a therapist or a support group or network, can be really instrumental, as Kat said, to learn and understand, because that is really key in supporting a loved one with ADHD or any diagnosis. Also, couples counseling can be really helpful if you are finding that there are some communication barriers or even just, you know, navigating some of the complex things that may arise if you both have ADHD or one has ADHD, that can be really helpful as well. Yeah, and even just understanding treatment plans together, it can be helpful to maybe work with a therapist together.
Absolutely. And speaking of treatment, Ames, what is, I guess, the best practice for treatment?
So treatment is very individualized. So this may look different for person to person, but generally speaking, it is usually a pharmacological and therapy-based approach. So that usually looks like a combination of medication and psychological intervention. So as we mentioned, medication will usually include stimulant medication, sometimes non-stimulant medication, maybe antidepressants as well. One thing that's really important, I guess, to consider when looking at medications is that you are working with a psychiatrist, like Kat said, to do a complete and comprehensive medical assessment, because a lot of medication treatment for ADHD are stimulants. Risk factors around cardiovascular health is really, really important, and a psychiatrist will be able to talk you through those things. And again, like I said, different medications for different people. So a psychiatrist is really the best person to go to for treatment options. Evidence does suggest that behavioral therapy tends to be the most effective for ADHD treatment. However, there are also other treatment plans that have been really effective, like a mindfulness-based approach. But yeah, generally a behavioral therapy in combination with medication is the stock standard approach, but that doesn't mean that you have to be medicated. Yeah, that is something, again, that you could talk with a psychiatrist or a mental health practitioner around the best treatment plan for you.
Okay. Tips and tools. All right. If, you know, you are someone, and there are certainly a lot of behavioral interventions that you can implement into your life to make life just a little bit easier for you if you do suffer from ADHD. It really depends on the category of if you're inattentive or if you're hyperactive or impulsive. Just rule of thumb, you know, it's going back to basics. It's looking at your sleep schedule, looking at your diet, exercise. Ames and I will always preach this till the cows come home. That will always be a really helpful way to at least be able to regulate your emotions, to set up a good schedule, just to make sure everything's working in order for this beautiful red race car of yours. It's putting good petrol in the tank. This metaphor's never getting old. I love this. Putting your premium unleaded in the tank and making sure it's serviced regularly. Also, I think routine and schedules are really, really important for anyone who has ADHD. Often you can feel as though you just get so lost, or you withdraw, or you just become so fixated on something else. Having schedules and having breaks, you need a lot more stimulation or a lot less stimulation than, I guess, the normal sedan. So making sure that if you're studying or working, it is not realistic to expect that you can sit there for 3 hours on a task that isn't interesting. You know, see how long you can go, like maybe try 10 minutes of work and then go for a walk around the office or around your house, or go for a bit of a walk outside, or do some exercise, or, you know, tune into something that's really interesting to you. I think making sure that you schedule your day that's really realistic in order to feel as though you've accomplished something rather than feeling disappointed that you haven't accomplished anything will be really helpful for your sense of reward. Also, we spoke about sensory, you know, really acknowledging if you respond well to study music, or, you know, having music headphones can be a really great sensory thing to ensure that you're feeling as though you're getting some self-soothing or you're getting some stimuli, but it's not disrupting your routine or your work or your study. Whether it is you need squishy toys, fidget toys, all of those things are helpful. If you're someone who moves a lot and you like to kind of move your body, if you're at a desk, I found that sitting on a Bosu ball can be really helpful, or having like a little ball underneath your feet to kind of kick around while you're studying. Anything that lets you fidget without taking your attention away from the task will be awesome here. And there's so many fidget toys and fidget tools that you can have a look at. There's fidget jewelry, which a few of my clients have, which has been really helpful. I find those things really helpful. Yeah, Ames, what do you think?
I agree. I think having a calendar is really, really helpful for the structure routine. If it's not on the calendar, it doesn't exist. I find working with clients, having like a week at a glance calendar is really helpful for executive functioning, you know, prioritizing, decision making, planning, all of that kind of thing. And I actually recommend having a handwritten rather than a digital calendar, because sometimes having a digital calendar can be conflicting with the organizing, because we can sometimes become a bit distracted by our screens, and that doesn't help with things like procrastination. So having a handwritten little calendar or a structure can be really helpful for things like prioritizing, breaking smaller tasks down day by day or hour by hour. And like Kat said, you know, we can pop in some breaks like physical activity and self-care, and having good sleep hygiene are really important. Like I said, mindfulness practices like meditation are very challenging for someone with ADHD, but extremely helpful. I would also really recommend therapy for unraveling some of those stuck points. As I mentioned, there is a really big overlap with trauma and ADHD symptoms. And if we, as adults, if we have developed with that narrative of there's something wrong with me and I feel like a failure and I can't do anything right, I'm not enough, and we've had parents that have been really authoritarian and punitive and disciplined our behavior rather than understanding that, you know, we've developed coping strategies in response to unmet attachment needs, you know, usually our mind scatters when reality is too harsh. And so we scatter the pain. So sometimes a scattered mind is really a response to a traumatized mind and having some unmet needs and some residual trauma from childhood. So I tend to look at it by, rather than, I guess, addressing behavior first, looking at, you know, kind of the cause and what happened rather than what's wrong and what do we need to fix. So absolutely, you know, problematic aspects like impulsivity, impatience, interrupting people, disorganization or tuning out, where did that start? And looking at those functions, you know, from a child's brain that might be stuck in some early stages of development, from a brain that had to adapt to some unsafe environment. So also regulating the nervous system to make life more manageable and to be able to be present and to be able to attend, because when our nervous system's dysregulated, like I said before, our cognitive processing goes out the window. And so I would actually start there, because all of those behavioral strategies, well, if our nervous system is still dysregulated, we're actually not absorbing any of that. So sometimes, you know, that can perpetuate that, you know, therapy's not even working. You know, I can't even do the therapy right. So I think it's always really important to start there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Love that. All right. If you are listening and you feel as though, oh, I think that, you know, this really resonates with me, this really could be something I want to explore, you know, you can chat to your, as we spoke about, your doctor, your therapist, or just do a little bit of your own exploration into ADHD. Please do not self-diagnose just because you saw it on TikTok. Please make sure you do get some medical support around that. But yeah, I think we just really wanted to normalize today that ADHD means that there's nothing wrong with you at all. Your brain just works differently, and that's okay. The fact that you've adapted to mainstream life is pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We hope that was helpful. Thank you so much for all your amazing questions. We, you know, we really tried to get through all of them, but we are never short and sharp in anything. Let us know if you have any more questions, and if we do get enough, we're happy to do a part two answering questions. We hope that was helpful, and thank you guys so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, guys. See you next time.
Bye.
But we won't see you. We'll
hear us next time.
Hear us next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.